The Tom Woods Show, episode 1857.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Gary Chartier week continues. And today we're going to talk about Christianity and the market economy and whether there is necessary antagonism between the two. Gary and I have both given a lot of thought to this subject and spoken and written about it. And I've written a book called The Church and the Market, A Catholic Defense of the Free Economy. I'll link to it on the show notes page. And Gary has written a tremendous book on business ethics, A Good Life in the Market, that we've talked about in a previous episode. So we're going to have a lot to talk about today. Gary, welcome back.
Good to be here, Tom.
Another great topic we have today, and this time it's Christianity and the market, which is a topic that should be of interest to people regardless of their opinions of Christianity, because Christianity is ubiquitous and it has played a very significant role in our culture and the way we think about a lot of things, whether we realize it or not. So I want to dig into this by first reminding people about your book on business ethics. And I'm so sorry, I don't remember the title. We did an episode on it.
Yeah, it's called A Good Life in the Market.
Yes. Okay. So I'll link to that on the show notes page. I'm a huge fan of this book. Now, there are a lot of questions that we can get into here, but what occurred to me right off the bat was, I'm sure you're familiar with Deirdre McCloskey's thesis about the importance of the image, the way people looked at and thought about the significance and indeed gave moral approval to the merchant and merchant activity, and that this helped to overcome a long-standing prejudice that merchants were engaged in something somehow underhanded or weren't really making any real contributions or whatever. Just the kinds of ideas that would tend to retard economic development, because it undermines support for major contributors to that development. Now, if I look at, not the Bible, but if I look at, let's say, the church fathers, I would not exactly feel like they had gone through a course by Murray Rothbard about the importance of the merchant. So how do we, when we look at the connection between Christianity and the marketplace and whether the two are at odds or favorable toward one another, I think we do have to reckon with the tradition as well. And early on, it's hard to find a lot of super duper support for the market unless I'm missing it.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And obviously, it would be anachronistic to wish that the fathers had read Deirdre's work, but I wish they had. The reality is, as we know, that there is a lot of suspicion there. And it often seems to me to be associated with a kind of zero-sum view of economic activity, right? With the idea that there aren't mutual gains as a result of trade. Rather, when one gains, the other loses. And so unavoidably then, trade comes to be seen as a kind of exploitative activity. And it's really unfortunate that that's the case. Probably it's not at all a view that's unique, you know, to the fathers, who are obviously, in many ways, very sophisticated thinkers, many of them, but they're also dealing with, you know, probably a set of assumptions about economic life that are prevalent in their intellectual environment. My own view is that, and I should offer a shout out that your regular listeners may not need, but I was just revisiting your book, The Church and the Market, which I thought about when it occurred to me to suggest this topic, and this is why I thought you and I could have an interesting conversation about this. A great book. And one that I hope, you know, even if it doesn't seem kind of as much in the area in which some listeners might be interested, I hope they'll check it out. But in any case, it seems to me it is really important to make the distinction that you make there between a moral vision on the one hand and an understanding of, you know, kind of what that looks like in practice, given
yes,
the reality of the way the world works. And so if, for instance, we can move past that idea that all economic transactions are zero sum, then while drawing on the same, you know, kind of moral principles, we get very different results, you know, when we start to think about human interaction in the market. So that's, you know, that's the direction I'd want to go. I think that I want to have a, you know, not a kind of narrow, atomistic, procedural conception of morality. I want to embrace a rich understanding of human flourishing of a kind that I happily admit is rooted in the Aristotelian Thomist tradition, happy to be associated with that tradition. But I think precisely if I care about human flourishing, I can see market relationships as both directly and indirectly fostering that kind of flourishing, and indeed in many ways embodying that kind of flourishing. So I don't want to somehow reject this crucial set of moral insights in the tradition, but I want to suggest that given what we know now about human social existence, we can see a flourishing not as somehow at odds with market relationships, but instead as served by them.
I want to add, since you mentioned the church and the market, you might be interested to know, in case it wasn't clear from the text, that when I wrote that, and it seems like a lifetime ago at this point, I was actually writing it not so much with, let's say, traditional left liberals in mind, but rather with right-wingers in mind, traditionalists, yes. Because I found that some of them took the view that, you know, capitalism and socialism are, I know you don't care for the term capitalism, but, you know, the market, market economy and socialism are, they're more or less the same thing because they have the same, quote, anthropology. And it was always this pompous nonsense that made me crazy. And they were looking for the elusive third way. And they just, and their view sometimes seemed like, well, the free market came out of the Enlightenment and we hate that. So we can't support any of that. So I just finally just couldn't take it anymore. I was tired of having these arguments with them. So I thought, I'm going to write this book and then I never have to talk about this ever again. So that was my goal with that. Now, when you talk about flourishing, obviously, given that exchange is not a zero-sum game, we both, you know, at both sides of the exchange come out ahead in the market economy, you know, with the ex ante. But how about just in isolation, just the entrepreneur? Like, I've seen the Acton Institute do some work on trying to situate the role of the entrepreneur somehow within our moral framework. So how do you think about, you know, as being a creative force and so on and so forth? How does that fit in?
No, I love that. I haven't read the Acton Institute material that you were talking about, so I can't comment on it directly. But I think the idea that the you know, the Misesian entrepreneur who is alert to opportunity, who is committed to you know, kind of mobilizing productive resources and responding to consumer needs, to, you know, taking the initiative to do that, it seems to me the entrepreneur plays a crucial role in developing and distributing products of all kinds. And I think we can absolutely see that, first of all, as a way in which the entrepreneur is, as it were, directly flourishing by exercising creativity and practical reasonableness in understanding what's going on, interpreting what's going on, and mobilizing resources. The entrepreneur is also flourishing, it seems to me, directly through the relationships that he or she participates in as that mobilization of resources happens. And then, of course, the entrepreneur is contributing directly or indirectly to the flourishing of all the consumers who benefit from the products that the entrepreneur brings to market. And then, of course, the entrepreneur benefits indirectly, being able to pursue, you know, his or her own desired path to flourishing with the resources gained as a result of that. So, no, I think there are lots of different ways in which the activity of the entrepreneur intersects with human flourishing. Absolutely.
Sometimes I come across people in the Christian tradition who seem to think that, maybe you've seen this too, if only we had another really great depression, that might bring people back to spiritual values and so on. And whereas now they're comfortable and therefore they're devoted to frippery and so on. But I am not convinced by that thesis at all. I actually think that it's because people have their needs met that they have the wherewithal to pursue not just specifically religious values, but also just other things like having a book club in your home or pursuing some higher intellectual interest. You can't do that if you're living hand to mouth. And so one of the ways I try to explain to people the way a wealthy person benefits you, even though you don't get to spend money directly out of that person's account, let's say a wealthy person whose wealth comes about in a completely unobjectionable way. In fact, I guess this is also a way of explaining to people the value of the division of labor. There's a YouTube account, I can't remember the name of it, where the guy tries to create all these different things completely on his own from scratch, and he goes around the world and he gets the ingredient, you know, and it's totally impossible, right? He made a turkey sandwich and he did everything. I mean, he harvested the wheat. I mean, he did absolutely everything. And it took him months and months and months, and then he said the sandwich was just sort of okay, right? And of course, this is costing thousands of dollars, but the fact that that sandwich or that chair or whatever actually costs you $10 or $100 instead of thousands and thousands, that's the way the wealthy person benefits you. Not necessarily that you get a job working for him or even the fact that he created the product, but it's that he created it because of using the division of labor so much more inexpensively than you could have if you were just left as a hunter-gatherer trying to support yourself, that you now have this leisure time to live a life that I think is worthy of a human being, that you're not in the fields 12 hours a day, you know, that you actually have the ability to live the way that makes possible enjoyment of higher things.
So I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think there are so many different things one might say about that view that you began by articulating. I think there's a kind of deep-seated, you know, philosophical and theological problem with the view that, well, probably it's not worth our time to wander down that path, but I think it's just deeply mistaken in terms of how it thinks about the relationship between God and the world. But in any case, just at the more practical level, you know, I was reminded when you were speaking of observations that you make in your book about Hilaire Belloc's view that somehow, you know, it would just be good if we all had productive property on our own and we're all somehow able to produce the goods that we desire for ourselves. And I think, you know, there's something really kind of just bizarre about that idea. First of all, because ironically, it's a denial of the very sociality that it seems like people like Belloc would normally want to affirm, right?
Thank you. Yes.
We're interdependent with each other, and that's a good thing. And the other thing is, if we're interdependent with a bunch of people, no one person then is able to dominate us. And with respect to most of those people, most of the time, we are in fact quite independent. So, it's just kind of a deeply wrongheaded kind of conception that somehow we should try to escape from social interdependence in the interests of, well, I don't know what, but certainly not, as you point out, kind of the higher things in life.
I want to get to your book on business ethics just very broadly. Sure. And I know you did not write that, obviously, just with Christians in mind, but obviously I can understand how a Christian audience would be interested in the moral questions raised by our activity in the marketplace. And so I guess my question is, would it be the case that some of the moral obligations that a good person operating in the marketplace would have to take on in the way he conducts his business, is there a sense in which this means that that type of business leader would be put at a disadvantage because other people can be underhanded and rotten without any moral qualms? So does that mean the bad guy wins?
Well, I don't think it means the bad guy wins for a whole host of reasons, right? That is, we might think about the way in which the good guy is a consistent, you know, source of trust. His goodness is a consistent source of trust on the part of others, both the people he works with and the suppliers and others he engages with. I mean, I do think we have to be realistic about the fact that right now we're in a deeply, it seems to me, distorted environment in this way, that the bad guy can win by, I think that one of the worst things that bad guys do, one of the most ethically problematic things that bad guys do, which I try to talk about at more than one point in the book, is by seeking state-secured privilege, right? By saying, I'm going to go and get trade barriers put in place. I'm going to go and get subsidies for my activities. And, you know, I'm going to go press for regulations that hobble, say, my smaller competitors. And so I do think we have to recognize that, let's say, in that last case, the smaller competitors who may be behaving in perfectly, you know, moral ways may well be hobbled and put out of business there. So it's not that we have to somehow pretend that when the bad guys really are bad in that way, that doesn't have an impact on the market and it doesn't have an impact on their competitors. So I think if we're talking about a genuinely free society in which it's not possible for, you know, somebody's bad behavior to result in those kinds of profoundly market-distorting privileges, in which rather bad behavior is going to involve, you know, being dishonest with competitors or with consumers rather, and, you know, just, you know, being mean to workers and so forth. In that case, that kind of person's behavior really, I think, is going to be self-defeating over the long term. The problem we confront right now is that bad behavior can invoke the state.
Hey, folks, just a quick message from our sponsor, Blinkist. Let's face it. Let's be honest with each other. You and I are nerds, right? We love to read books, and the more books we hear about, the more books we add to our list, and it becomes overwhelming, and we wonder how we're ever going to get to all of them. Well, the solution is an amazing app called Blinkist. The way it works is very simple. They take thousands of nonfiction bestsellers, and they take the key ideas and insights and condense them down into 15-minute text and audio explainers that help you understand more about the core ideas. So you can dive into a topic quickly. You can find out if you really want to read the entire book. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories. I like Blinkist because in just a matter of 15 minutes, I can get a really solid grounding in something I'm curious about. I've used it when driving around, when taking a walk, and I particularly enjoyed recently Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. But you can also find libertarian classics on Blinkist like Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman, or For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Okay, now let's move on. I want to get to the probably the main questions people would have involving, let's say, the biblical text itself, because here we're, I think if you read it deeply, you can find in general the kind of principles on which a market society is built. But if you read it kind of superficially, it sounds like a lot of criticism of rich people. And so people draw from that, well, therefore X, Y, and Z. So how do you address that, the impression that a casual reader might get that the message of the Bible is, you know, rich people are going to be brought down hard. And that's not exactly Adam Smith talking.
No, it's certainly not. So none of us today is, of course, an expert on what's really going on in the minds and hearts of people, say, in the first century, Mediterranean, or even earlier than that, if you think about in biblical Israel. So we can't be sure what's going on there. But it does seem as if, again, we need to be alert to the degree to which two factors are relevant, right? On the one hand, again, I think the idea that, you know, people in one way or another are often expected to have acquired wealth and quite possibly have acquired wealth in dodgy ways. And this, again, is, I think, associated with the widespread idea that the only way you get wealth in this kind of economy is at the expense of others. And so I think to the extent that those characterizations are accurate with regard to the particular environment out of which some biblical texts emerge, if, you know, when, say, biblical prophets talk about, you know, the wealthy adding house to house, and it really is the case in this context that, you know, people are behaving badly, whether in a way that, you know, really actually is, you know, a violation of what we think ought to be legal norms, or even if that's not the case in some ethically problematic way, then I think we can certainly understand the reactions there and see those reactions as illuminating and as pointing to behavior that we ought to be quite concerned about. We also see sometimes, say, for instance, in the Epistle of St. James, the idea that the wealthy get preferential treatment and favoritism in the church and pushback there. You know, I don't have the book in front of me, but as I recall, we have James saying, isn't it odd that you're giving preference to these people when they're in fact the ones who are hauling you into court and ripping you off and so forth? And so, you know, it seems to me that's a situation where you might well think, yeah, perhaps perhaps we're talking here about the behavior of wealthy people who really are not doing as they ought to do. I think that's a different matter, of course, than asking what happens if we embrace a moral vision, in particular, of persons as fundamentally equal in moral rights and moral status and merit for moral consideration, if we think about that broad moral vision and about the degree to which the desire for a flourishing community that doesn't leave the vulnerable behind can be met through the institutions of the unfettered market. And so a lot really does depend, I think, on the extent to which you kind of get immersed in the particulars of a given historical situation and some of the background assumptions that might be in play in that historical situation versus, you know, operating a higher level of generality, thinking about, a moral vision and thinking about how that might play out. I don't think that means that, you know, we're going to find anywhere a primer on market economics lurking in the biblical texts. And I think we do have to recognize the assumptions people arrive with and the way in which small village mentality sometimes can get unhelpfully extended to an entire impersonal society, the sort of thing that Hayek talks about in The Fatal Conceit. But I think still allowing for that, I think there's a much smaller gap there than I think the critics sometimes suppose, the folks who think that, you know, somehow instead really what's going on in the Bible is just is some kind of Marxist vision that we should just embrace and implement.
I'm sorry that in this conversation I'm just jumping from one question to another, but I just have things that I want to ask you and I want to make sure I get them all in. So another one has to do with the issue of intention. Now, if somebody does something bad on purpose, we evaluate that morally differently from if they do something bad by accident. Obviously, if I push you down the stairs, that's different from if I, you know, accidentally, you know, I fell and it accidentally made you fall. Okay, so that's one thing. But suppose we're dealing with doing good things. Now, Adam Smith talks about people doing good without necessarily fully comprehending all the good that they're doing, you know, like the baker bakes the bread and all that, not necessarily because he recognizes all the ancillary benefits of what he's doing, but because he's trying to make a living. And yet there are entrepreneurs out there who you could say have benefited mankind more than any single, let's say, volunteer at a charitable institution ever. But yet the volunteer at the charitable institution has a clear intention of, I want to help people. The entrepreneur maybe just wants to line his own pocket, and yet maybe winds up doing more practical good. How do we morally evaluate these two different people?
Yeah, you know, I do think it is very important when we're thinking about kind of institutional questions or questions of social practice, right? We've got to remember a quip that the great philosopher David Schmitz makes somewhere, that if your main goal is to show that your heart is in the right place, it probably isn't. And the desire simply to express good attitudes, to engage, therefore, in a kind of virtue signaling, can really be a distraction from actually behaving in effective ways. So it seems to me that as a general matter, when we think about the activities in which we engage as market participants, seems to me that we can operate at a couple of different levels. And I don't think this is at all schizophrenic. I don't think it's impossible to think this way. And I think it's important to bear both in mind. That I can be aware, on the one hand, that the institutions and practices of a market economy are beneficial not just to the individual entrepreneurs or even the individual consumers who participate, but indeed are widely, broadly, societally beneficial. And I can affirm those practices and institutions With that in mind, that means that I can support those institutions in appropriate ways, to not seek to undermine them, be aware of the value of the legal framework that's needed to sustain them, and be affirming of that, and so forth. That's quite compatible with not paying a lot of conscious attention to that when I'm involved in an individual market transaction. I have to be aware of that background, and I think to be kind of morally responsible with respect to the market, I do have to be sensitive to that, alert to that, affirming of that, and you know, not just, you know, I think narrowly concerned about what's happening in my own case, but I think it's entirely reasonable that on a day-to-day basis, I may not be thinking about that. On the other hand, even in the case of the individual transaction, I think it's entirely appropriate to recognize the mutual benefit that's involved in that transaction, the way in which one's participation in it is contributing, you know, to the flourishing of those involved. So, you know, that's perhaps not the same kind of thing that's going on if I'm working as a volunteer, volunteering at a soup kitchen once a week or something like that. It's a different kind of concern, but I think it's just important to recognize that even in the case of the ordinary merchant, there's no reason that merchant can't be alert in the moment to the ways in which what he or she is doing contribute not only to his or her own flourishing, but to that of customers, and that she or he and the customers can all be aware, can affirm, quite apart from their own immediate benefit, the general benefit that their participation in and support of the market order serves to foster.
Well, how do we address and overcome the idea that not just Christians, but a lot of people have, that the market economy is a place of dog-eat-dog competition? And you know, we tend to portray it as a massive example of global cooperation, but they look at it as dog-eat-dog competition with one firm trying to take down the other firm, and they just look at that and say, that can't be the most moral system. That can't be the system that encourages human cooperation and flourishing. How about that objection?
Yeah, and I love the fact that you emphasize global cooperation, because yeah, when I talk about the extended market order, I love to use that kind of language to talk about peaceful, voluntary, extended social cooperation, because I think that is what's going on. And I think reframing the economic relationships that we see in the market that way seems really vital. I do recognize that people think the way you've described. I guess I think one way in which it might make sense to think about that is that the only way, ultimately, that competition that's so central to market activity works is the only way that that actually is successful is insofar as it provides consumers with what those consumers are seeking. That it's an alternative that a successful firm provides that the consumer actually wants. And yeah, I mean, I think it is petty and maybe worse if my goal as a competitor is to stick it to the other guy. I'm not in favor of that morally from the standpoint of the entrepreneur. It seems to me the entrepreneur is trying to do the best job possible to attract the consumer. And obviously, therefore, I have to be aware as an entrepreneur of what the alternatives are and what it is that the consumer is going to be looking at. But my goal, it seems to me, is to come up with the option that's going to be most attractive, that's going to be most appealing to the consumer, not to undermine, attack, put out of business, out of hostility somehow, the other participants in the market. The point is just to do my job as well as possible. When I do, then I do get the signal that a profit gives me that indeed I'm doing the right thing and I keep doing it and I hope do it better. But I can do that, it seems to me, without somehow being immersed in petty hostility of the kind that I think the critics are worried about.
This conversation, in a way, reminds me, and by design, because I designed it this way, it reminds me of the way Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State is set up. He spends chapter after chapter after chapter working out what social cooperation looks like and what the results of it are. And that is, you know, he covers production and interest rates and all that. But the state comes in only at the end. Now, the normal book brings the state in right at the beginning because it's a major partner in the economy and in steering the economy. But Rothbard includes it as an afterthought and as a parasite, as something that's not necessary, that comes in and screws up the beautiful design I just spent all the previous chapters describing to you. Well, likewise, in this conversation, we haven't really talked about the state. We've talked about the market economy and human interaction. So that particular actor is going to come onto the stage in the next episode, where you and I will talk about Christianity and the state, which is a topic I get a lot of requests for, and that I do accommodate that from time to time, but it's been a while. So that's what you and I will talk about next time. So thanks, Gary.
Sounds great.
All right, everybody. If you like and appreciate what's going on here on the Tom Woods Show, then head over to supportinglisteners.com. If you're a supporter of the show, my goodness, do you get a lot of goodies. Not to mention membership in my super exclusive group, The Tom Woods Show Elite, which will keep you sane during difficult times. So check that out at supportinglisteners.com. More Gary Chartier Week tomorrow. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.